supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The midnight deadline is fast approaching for Pennsylvania lawmakers to comply with a state Supreme Court mandate to submit proposals regarding congressional district boundaries. Joining me live on the line from Harrisburg with the latest is WHYY's Katie Meyer. Good evening, Katie.
Good evening.
Review why the state Supreme Court issued this mandate.
So the state Supreme Court ruled Pennsylvania's congressional maps unconstitutional about a few weeks ago now. It was last month. And they ruled them unconstitutional on the basis that they were a partisan gerrymander. So they said that the maps favored Republicans and that they were drawn specifically to favor Republicans. And so in issuing orders to draw new maps, they told lawmakers to make districts more compact and more contiguous and to split fewer municipalities and counties. And they ordered them to do that within 3 weeks. And then they said if they didn't do that, the Supreme Court itself would, use a consultant to draw the new maps. And so, lawmakers were supposed to work kind of in a bipartisan fashion. The General Assembly was supposed to pass a map to Governor Tom Wolf, who would either accept it or veto it and send it to the court. None of that really happened. There was never any bipartisan work on this. Part of that is because the court didn't give over its full, guidance to lawmakers until a few days before their deadline. And so lawmakers say that really messed up the process, but Republicans ended up just unilaterally submitting a couple of maps, or one map, and then Wolf vetoed it, and now we're waiting to see if Wolf will file his own map. He said he would do that by 5 today. It's now 6:07, so we're still waiting.
Well, you're in Harrisburg. Are his lights still on?
His lights are on. Staff are definitely there. They're just not answering their phones, and we don't quite know. We don't even know if he plans to submit a map. They haven't confirmed that. So it's really, it's a waiting game around here. There's a lot of frustration.
Above and beyond today's apparently sliding deadline is the permanent date ahead. That's the May 15th primary election. This does have to be resolved long before then, I presume.
Yes. And so this deadline, this very quick turnaround, the 3 weeks that the court gave the legislature, is in deference to that deadline. And if they don't make, so the court is saying that they will have a map enacted by the 19th, so that's this coming Monday. And if they don't make that date, it's questionable whether there's enough time to get petitions filed and to actually have the election on time. Now, lots of lawmakers are saying they would like to, I mean, they can, change the date of the primary maybe. It's, it's unclear how much that's going to be flexible and if there's going to be will to change those dates. But, a lot of lawmakers said, okay, fine, we can redraw the maps, but let's not do it for this election. They're saying that in and of itself is a partisan move by the court, a Democratic-controlled court, to favor Democrats in this coming election. So, I guess the point being there's a lot of tension around this. It's a really sort of bitterly partisan dispute that's going on in Harrisburg right now.
Thanks, Katie. Mm-hmm. WHYY's Katie Meyer on NewsWorks Tonight. In other news today, the top federal prosecutor for the Philadelphia area has come out swinging at the concept of a safe injection site. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the criticism from the region's chief federal law enforcement official comes just as city leaders proceed with a plan to open the first facility in the country where drug users can inject under medical supervision.
U.S. Attorney Lou Lappin is not into the idea of creating a place for opioid users to inject drugs under the eye of trained staff. Lappin called the concept of a safe injection site oxymoronic. He says the establishment of such a facility in Philadelphia would be more like, quote, a self-suicide site.
You're talking about an extremely dangerous situation with people injecting these drugs into their veins that is killing them at rates we have never seen before in the history of the world. So it's not something that we can just say, wow, that's a really great idea.
Lappin hadn't previously addressed the issue publicly. He made his comments at a press conference about the formation of an anti-opioid task force among state and federal prosecutors across the Philadelphia area. It's aimed at bolstering law enforcement resources to arrest sellers and distributors of opioids. Mayor Jim Kenney and District Attorney Larry Krasner have said that a supervised injection site would be a place where users can bring their own drugs and access clean equipment to shoot up. But it's also a place where those not in treatment can be placed into services to help them deal with their addiction. Lappin says the Department of Justice sees it differently.
It speaks to the horror of the situation that we find ourselves in and doesn't seem to be the best way to address a crisis.
Opioids were the main driver in what officials believe were 1,200 overdose deaths in Philadelphia last year. That's four times the city's murder rate. Backers of safe injection sites compare them to how needle exchanges helped save lives during the AIDS crisis. But federal prosecutors say such a site could draw more drug users to the city and might normalize the use of heroin and other opioids. Lappin is expected to be replaced by lawyer Bill McSwain, who was nominated in December by President Trump. If confirmed, McSwain would have the same boss as Lappin, Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
As more and more businesses look to use drones, the demand for FAA-certified commercial drone pilots is soaring. With all of this money-making potential, drone schools are popping up across the country, and that includes one in Wilmington. WHYY's Shirley Min tells us about Drone Workforce Solutions.
That whirring is the sound of Ray Buchta's drone lifting off. Aerial shots add a lot when he's producing videos for work at Delaware Digital Video Factory in North Wilmington.
There's some jobs that you do where you want to highlight a property or somebody's business. And we're also doing a lot of photography, so there's a lot of applications for the drone work.
Buchta earned his Federal Aviation Administration certification last year. Flying a drone for fun is one thing, but if you want to make money piloting a drone, you need an FAA certification.
It's an emerging market. I mean, it's definitely a lot of potential out there. It's hard to put a number on it, I would say, but it's definitely fun to watch and fun to be involved in because there's a lot of stuff coming on the horizon. And then you also have like Amazon and all these places that UPS that want to start delivering with drones, and that's a whole nother industry in itself. But yes, 10, 20 years from now, we may have drones flying all over the place.
Drone Workforce Solutions, or DWS, is the brainchild of Theo Nix, who's a lawyer, not a pilot.
Every industry is going to be impacted or could be impacted by the use of drones.
With a $59,000 Delaware Department of Labor grant, Nix developed a 10-week, 70-hour curriculum, combining classroom work with hands-on flying time for 12 students. Because of the grant, it's tuition-free.
We train people who are interested in getting into drone technology by teaching them how to fly drones, how to pass the Federal Aviation Administration exam, how to edit the data that they get, and how to build a drone.
There are lots of online choices when it comes to drone training, but what differentiates DWS is that it's not only in person, but it also helps graduates find work.
We hire drone operators from around the country who populate our site with the information. We validate the information that they're FAA certified, that they have their licenses, what kind of drones they fly, where are they in the country. And when we have jobs from employers, we can then on our apps, free apps, send that information to the drone operators who become part of the Drone Workforce Solution family and ask them what if they're interested in the job. Here's how much they're paying. This is what's required. Who's interested?
DWS's inaugural class of 12 included Gabe Cruz.
I saw opportunity. I didn't hesitate. I was like, look, it's a new industry that's pretty much untouched territory in Delaware. So I was like, hey, why not?
FAA certified, Cruz is ready to work.
This is definitely career worthy. Anybody could make a full-time career out of this. The sky's the limit. So I can do anything from inspections. I can do agricultural. I can do, you know, the typical cinematography as well, where I can fly in the sky, do some editing. Editing is going to be a really big skill to have when it comes to, you know, aerial drone videography.
And apparently, there's a lot of money to be made. Investment bank Goldman Sachs forecasts drones to grow to a $100 billion industry by 2020 worldwide. Demand from the military alone is projected to account for $70 billion. Consumers, like you and me, are expected to spend $17 billion buying drones, and businesses and local governments account for the remaining $13 billion. That $13 billion is what Nix is going after.
So right now we're targeting the utility companies. Agriculture is huge, so we can do what's called precision intervention and really pinpoint for farmers where their issue is in the field. Instead of spraying the whole 1,000 acres, for example, we can show a farmer where the issue is in his field, and then they can spray just that area, saving them millions of dollars over a period of time.
There are 60,000 FAA-certified commercial drone pilots, and the number is growing. Nix is applying for another grant from the state to cover tuition for a second class, but says otherwise tuition will cost $6,000. From the Delaware desk, Shirley Min, WHYY News.
We're just under 24 hours out from the annual Happy Feet Fest at Happy Valley. Let's lace up our blue suede shoes with Brady Lucas, Special Events Director with Thon. Brady, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
No, thank you so much for having me.
Thon is short for marathon, short for dance marathon, and the legacy at Penn State goes all the way back to 1973, long before your time. But give us a sense of what's happened in the intervening decades.
Yes, so the Penn State Dance Marathon is the largest student-run philanthropy in the world. We have 16,500 student volunteers every single year that participate in a year-long effort culminating in a 46-hour, no-sitting, no-sleeping dance marathon. So we have 708 dancers, just over 700 dancers, that stand on their feet for 46 hours every single February, which is pretty incredible to think about.
Brady, it's amazing. Since its inception, Thon has apparently raised more than $146 million. Where does that money go?
All the money from the organization that we raise benefits our sole beneficiary, the Four Diamonds Fund, at Penn State Hershey Children's Hospital. And this fund ensures that no family ever sees a bill from any of the cancer treatment. So it's pretty incredible. And also we are able to provide, you know, funding for critical research that is being able to be groundbreaking all over the country.
It's not the last couple standing. The event ends precisely at 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon. What are the rules?
The way it works is at 6 p.m. on Friday night, the executive committee will go up to the stage and count down from 10. All dancers will stand at this point, and then from there, they are on their feet for 46 hours straight. So that means that they'll stand up to eat, you know, and do activities. There are a wide variety of activities that go on throughout the weekend. So it's a pretty, you know, crazy endurance activity for any person.
For those participants who anticipate getting to the finish line, what kind of training do they go through? It sounds like a same rigor as a running marathon.
Yeah, so a lot of people, for at least when I did it, so things that I did is I cut caffeine in around September. Some people may not cut it that far, but a lot of people will cut it, you know, starting the second semester. A lot of people start going to the gym and, you know, doing more endurance things here and there, running, you know, lifting weights, all that kind of stuff to get in shape. A big thing, too, is just staying hydrated throughout the week leading up to Thon. Going into that weekend, of course, you want to be as hydrated as possible. But in my opinion, I think about 95% of it is mentality. And the way that we kind of are very inspired through what goes on throughout the weekend is, of course, our Four Diamonds families and all the children that we do it for every single day and every decision that we make for them. A lot of them come to the event and, you know, they're squirting squirt guns or blowing bubbles or doing things that, you know, simply just let them be a kid. So, you know, seeing a kid on the floor squirting a squirt gun at you is pretty incredible and a pretty uplifting thing. You know, when you're all there for one cause, it's pretty easy to constantly go and constantly lean on your friends for so much support.
Brady, now let's turn to your story, and it very much pertains to the spirit and impetus for the event.
Yeah, so my story is I was actually diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia on April 14th, 2005. So I was actually, you know, a Four Diamonds child and a recipient of this amazing organization. So my treatment lasted from April 14th, 2005 until July 28th, 2008. During these times, my family never saw a medical bill for anything going on with the treatment. So so after that, I unfortunately relapsed my leukemia on September 20th, 2010. And I was age 14 then, age 8 when I was initially diagnosed. And then I was very fortunate to receive a life-saving bone marrow transplant from my little brother. So my little brother, Sean, was a perfect match for a bone marrow transplant. So he had the chance to donate his bone marrow at age 10, which is pretty incredible to think about. A 10-year-old and one of my siblings actually saved my life. The Four Diamonds provided so much for me. And, you know, the money does go an amazing way. But the biggest thing for me was always the emotional support. I always knew that, you know, if I gave up on my fight or gave up on anything, that there were 15,000 plus, now 16,500 plus, because we've grown so much. Students at Penn State, plus an extended Penn State family that, you know, was there cheering me on and there for anything that I possibly could need along the way.
Brady, thanks so much. Hope all goes well this weekend. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
Brady Lucas, Special Events Director with Thon. Finally this evening, we have a story of love lost and then found, all owing to dancing, or more precisely, bad dancing. Rachel Joyce shared her story at a recent First Person Arts of Philadelphia Story Slam for WHYY's Common Space. The theme, battle scars.
Hi, my name is Rachel, and the only physical scar I have is on my leg from when I steamed my dress while it was already on me. So I started to think about emotional scars, and there's one scar in particular that I could feel when I am dancing. And like all great stories, this one takes place in high school when I was dating a boy named Larry. Now, I thought Larry was the one. I thought he was it. And Larry and I were really cool and would go to these Battle of the Bands at the community center. So we were at the community center, and there was music, so I was dancing. Now, here's what you need to know about me and dancing. I love to dance. I would go steady with dancing. I would elope with dancing. Dancing would not claim me as its own. Dancing would not pick me for its team. Dancing would be like, I don't even like you as a friend. It's you, not me. Please leave. But I was dancing. And Larry was like, and we're 8 months in here, so we're like a thing. And Larry was like, Rachel, stop dancing. And I thought he was being cute, so I was like, you stop. Now, the thing about my dancing is that it's like 90% shoulders. I'm not the most coordinated, but I keep dancing. And he's like, Rachel, seriously, stop. And I'm like, any 15-year-old girl with spunk, I don't like being told what to do, so I keep dancing. And he's like, Rachel, seriously, let's just listen. This is why people ask me why I'm going out with you. And I stopped real quick. And the thing is, I didn't know that people asked him that. And this might be an indication of how sheltered my life is, but to this day, that is the meanest anyone has ever said to me. And we broke up a few months later for completely unrelated reasons. And, well, maybe they were related and I didn't realize. But we broke up, and I always think there's that moment that you break up, but there is always the moment before that where the love ran out, where you should have broken up, where you get scarred. And that was that moment, and I wish I walked away. I would date these other guys in high school, and I would be a little afraid to dance in front of them. I mean, I'd move, but the shoulders didn't come out. So after high school, I really met my people, because that's where weirdos meet their people, not in high school, unless you're really lucky. And in that group of people was an amazing guy who is still my boyfriend today. And I still go like this when I talk about him, so it's real. Been going out for 6 years. And I asked him, you think I'm a good dancer, right? Eventually, he's seen me dance and he's never told me to stop. And he said, well, first he laughed. He laughed for like a while when I asked him. And then he said, no. Oh God, no, Ray. No. You're a horrible dancer. You might be the worst. But, and there was a but, there's a but. He said, but if you were a good dancer, you wouldn't be Rachel. And I'm in love with Rachel. And I wish, I know, I just kind of floated away. And I wish I could bottle that moment and take it to my 15-year-old self and say, look, people who don't want you to be you don't belong in your life. So please, please dance your ass off.
Rachel Joyce's story comes to us from Common Space. It's a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's heard on the last Sunday of each month on WHYY-FM and via podcast. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.